This program is brought to you by PrideNZ.com.
I was born in the mid-60s in a lovely little town of Blenheim, top of the South Island. Didn't appreciate it much growing up, but when I go back to visit Marlborough now, the place is just beautiful. The whole area, the surrounding areas, the sounds, the valleys, the mountains, even snow sometimes. I love my hometown. Didn't while I was growing up, though. I was glad to leave.
Yeah. What didn't you like about it?
It's very small. Population 16,000. Life was school, church, youth group. There was one movie theatre. There wasn't a lot to do. So I didn't like that smallness. I always felt contained. But when I think back over it, my education was very good. I had lots of opportunity around sports and being involved in that way. But I felt like, I always felt like I needed to get away. Yeah.
And who's in your family?
Well, there's my mum and dad. They both passed away when I was 30. They were quite young. They were late 60s. Got my older sister, Rosie, who's 60. She was 60 last year, I think. Then my brother, Lindsay, passed away at the age of 50 of complications of a benign brain tumour during surgery. And I have another brother who's Michael. He lives in Timaru, the thriving metropolis of Timaru. And he's happily married down there to the lovely Gay. When my brother died, I think 7 years ago, I said to my remaining siblings, now there's three, that's us. And we've got closer as we've got older, as you do.
So you're pretty close. I went to your wedding last year, and I think you had family there.
Yeah, I did. My sister was there, and my brother and his wife were at my wedding to Mary. Mary and I met in 1991, because when I was leaving to Christchurch, someone gave me a present, an artwork by Mary, and said, if you ever met Mary, you would like her. So that was very prophetic, because I met Mary then 4 years later in 95 through a choir, actually, through what was known as the lesbian choir back then. We went for a couple of years.
Where was that?
In Wellington. I'm trying to remember how that set up. I was involved with some of it, but there were three or four of us who were musicians. I'd got back from Christchurch. People were talking about it. There had been a lesbian and gay choir in existence called Galaxies, which met from 1991, and they got together at Advent for the purposes of doing an Advent service at St. Andrews, which was a lesbian gay identified choir. But we also had a lesbian choir, a group of about 15 of us. We sang at Woman Spirit Rising and different women's conferences back. Gosh, this is long ago. So I met Mary in that context, and we went for a walk on a beach on the 12th of January of 1996, Parapanami Beach. And when we moved in together in the week my mother died, I was just starting to move my gear, and my mother died suddenly, so that's how my Mary met my family. At that huge event, it was overwhelming, really. So that's it, 96. We've just celebrated. Yeah, so when we decided we were together, we thought about what date would signify that, and that was a day we walked on the beach and we read some feminist books and quoted academically at each other and then ate a Magnum ice cream on the way home. And it was all very sweet. So we just celebrated 19 years. And in the course of that, I remember around about the four-year point, none of my relationships have ever lasted beyond 4 years. And I remember saying to her, what do we do now? And she said, don't we just carry on? And I remember laughing and thinking, yeah, actually you do. So we've had three major ceremonies in our life. 2003, I was very ill. I was told I had something in my brain that could have been a lesion or an infection or MS, and we didn't know what it was. And so they sent me home from hospital saying, put your fears in order, and we'll know in 6 weeks whether you're sicker or better, and it could have grown. So Mary and I, in 10 days, put together a commitment ceremony, because remember, this is 2003. We didn't have civil unions legalised even then. It's hard to think, 12 years ago, we didn't have that. And we had a small group of 12. For me, I said it at the reception table, it felt like the Last Supper. There was 13 people actually at the table. But we had a commitment ceremony, and my family flew up. And it was a very, very beautiful commitment ceremony. And then we waited. And then I turned 38. And then I had a Christmas. And then we realised what I had wasn't going to kill me, which was quite celebratory, as you can imagine. But did put a different flavour in our relationship in terms of what were we going to do with it. Because my partner, Mary, is 20 years older than me. And that does make a difference in terms of life change. So we came up to Aotaki and had a look around at properties, and we looked at this one. This is the fourth property we looked at, and then went, nah, it's too small, because this house is 70 square metres, the same as what our house was in Kilburnie. But we only had 1 metre between properties in Kilburnie. But we knew we had to move up here. We knew this was the next part of our relationship. This was So in 2006, we bought the property in 2005. In 2006, is we chose our anniversary that we walked on the beach. That would have been our 10-year anniversary. And we approached Margie Maiman at the St. Andrews on the Terrace, Margie being supportive of marriage equality. And I remember the debates leading up to civil unions, and Mary and I stood on the continuum of not supporting civil unions, because we believed that was less than a marriage equality. We got talked into supporting the campaign via our music and being visible and accepting the more liberal view that this was a pathway to marriage equality. And we stood in St. Andrews on the 12th of January of 2006 and reset our vows to each other. We had said in 2003 in a public ceremony with probably 60 people from my various workplaces, and had the most beautiful. Mary had returned to Catholicism at that point, and we were fortunate enough to have a priest who did a family reunion mass for us before we went down to St. Andrews and had that ceremony. And that was the way we started our partnered life, our legally partnered life, was up here in Aotaki. And we moved here full-time that year, not long after that ceremony. And then the miracle happened. Lewis Award's bill got chosen to be heard, the marriage equality, the marriage amendment. And we knew it wasn't going to be as huge as the civil union because it didn't require the same law change. And lo and behold, it passed. And I was in Chicago, and I knew the time difference. It was 19 hours, and it seemed like Wellington was still partying at 4 a.m. because I was up watching it. It was about 9 o'clock at night or something ridiculous. And I'm sitting thinking, what's happening in Wellington? And then I tuned into the Paukari Kariana, and I rang Mary and said, will you marry me? You know how I go, it was like getting down on my knees for the commitment ceremony, because I was very sick, so getting on my knee at that back in 2003. In 2003, I was going to propose to her. I had the Soames Island trip planned to stay overnight and propose, and I got sick and I was in hospital. But this was, so I rang and proposed, and then, of course, I did the Facebook proposal, and when I woke up next morning, there were 33 comments saying, is Mary going to say yes? Oh no, she hasn't answered. What is happening? What's the sign? So I had to text her and say, will you please get on Facebook and put people out of their misery? And I came home from my America trip. I was picked up at the airport. Mary was at a prayer meeting, for social justice issues and the Waihopai civil trial that was going on. And I arrived at St. Andrews and texted her to come out, and I got down on one knee on the steps of St. Andrews. And I had a labyrinth cup, that a bowl, little bowl that I'd bought from New York near the site of the 9/11, And that labyrinth's got a special meaning to us, and had a rosary ring in it, just for a little, you know, down on one knee. And I was so wobbly and so jet-lagged, this stranger walked by and ran up to me to grab me because she thought I'd fallen over. And then someone said, no, no, she's proposing. And everyone's laughing because a couple of friends were watching what was happening. And she stood back and went, oh, and applauded us. So Mary's been a huge part of my life, 19 years together. We're laughing at each other because she retired fully in June last year, as I decided to move my home business out of the home to a place down the road so we didn't spend too much time with each other. But I'm coming into retirement myself now, and we've just been joking with each other about, you know, leaving the butter knife on the bench and who sweeps the floor. So we're trying to, I guess we're doing role definition again now that our life's changing again. So Mary's been a huge part of my life. If someone had said to me 19 years ago, I would be happily married, living up the coast, and with a family of my choice as well, because it's got children in it to have seemed to have adopted us. It's just a whole new phase of life, and we're loving it.
Tell me about your adopted family.
Well, adopted family. They're a well-known family. Adrian, the papa of the family, our dadda, he was one of the three Waihopians, as we call them. In 2008, three Catholic worker men took some action against the spying base in Waihopai in Blenheim. They went down there and used a sickle and disarmed it in the name of Christ after the Isaiah verse that's printed on the United Nations wall in New York, that we will turn the swords into plowshares. So disarmed it in the name of peace. And I knew who the family was, and I was watching television one night, it was about 10, it was late news, and there is Adi, the man with the beard from church, being carried away, being taken away in handcuffs, in a boiler suit. And I went running and woke Mary up and said, you've got to see this. And there was a very, very big split in the community over the rights and wrongs of what had occurred, and Mary and I were definitely on the support this family. So about that time, the trial came along. The little one who's 6 now was about to turn 1. And we were facing the potential for Adi to be in jail for that time, for maybe 10 months, a year, we had thought. And that meant 7 children. And Mary and I just became more and more active, and the little ones loved us more and more, and we loved them more and more back. And if anyone had said there'd be a little one in my life, I would have laughed at them as well. And the jury saw fit not to find them not guilty on the basis of particular points of law about what they were doing, that they weren't terrorists, that they were activists. And they, I just loved this family's politics. And then I saw the family that I would have loved to have grown up in. You know, homeschooled, a big piece of land, growing up fully loved. And when I proposed to Mary and said, will you marry? She looked at me and she said, I'll do it. Cause she didn't want to, she's an introvert. Her idea of a party is 2 people. she said, I want to be married in their barn. And their barn is quite significant because we've had lots of barn dances in there over the years. And then when it came to the wedding, this family, and they are our family, hosted our wedding. And when I counted out later, it was a community event, so it was an open invitation. The 157 people came through the door that day, and they fed them with hangi. The hospitality, and they're so this Catholic worker ethos, which is live off the land as much as possible. There's Catholic worker farms all around the world, and it's open door. You need a place to live, you need a place to stay, and I've many times taken refuge there. I've never had to sleep there overnight. I've never had a fight with Mary that's required me to go and sleep there overnight. but they do have my couch because I donated it there. So we eat there. We fellowship there. We pray. We meditate together. I think one of my most favourite events at that house was 5 years ago. Every 5 years, there's six Catholic worker farms in New Zealand, I think, and they rotate. So this year it was back to their farm. So they've just had a hui about what Catholic workers are on the social justice left side of things. But the most fun workshop I ran there, I was asked to come and present a workshop, this is 5 years ago, on being a Christian feminist. And I didn't leave it there. Ah, Christian feminist anarchist. The anarchy was important. And so I also added in lesbian, feminist, Christian, anarchist. What is that and what does it look like? And it was the most incredible 2 hour fun as we looked at continuums and how they crossed each other. And again, pushing forward away from dichotomy into progressive Christian thought. So right on the left hand polar opposite to extreme fundamentalism. So that's the kind of things I get up to. Mary and I get up to with our adopted family.
Did you grow up in a Catholic family?
No, not as straightforward. My father was Catholic and my mother was Anglican. But my mother's parents were Salvation Army. So when my grandmother conceived my mum out of wedlock in 1928, things fell apart at the Salvation Army. And, so, because they were originally Macmillans and Scottish, they went to Presbyterian. But it just keeps swapping all over the place. And then on the Catholic side of my family, which is my father's, a huge fight when his father became an Anglican out of a Catholic family when there was a fight over land. So half the branch stayed Catholic. But my father's father was not baptized Catholic. And when his wife died, and she was Irish Catholic, something happened at the funeral. It was the year I was born. A big fight. And I wasn't offered the opportunity to attend a Catholic school. My father would have nothing to do with that. His grumpiness didn't come until a few months after I was baptised. So when I was very sick in 2003, I wrote to the Catholic Church in Blenheim and said, you know, was my father grumpy with you at the time or did he actually let me be baptised? And back came my baptism certificate. But in terms of church upbringing, it's always been part of my life. I think because we weren't having anything to do with the Catholics, my mum desperately needed peace and quiet on Sundays, so she sent my brother and I off down to the Anglican church down the road, and that was always fun. St Mark's was great, and because next door they had this little tiny town thing that you could go play with all the figures next to. So we were always shunted off to church, but we got to do cool things like, you know, plays, nativity plays and things like that. So quite fun things.
Who did you play?
Well, I wanted to be the angel, but my friend got to be angel. I was never allowed to be the angel because I never had the long blonde hair. It was just wrong. I tell you, I'm traumatised. Same thing happened in sixth form at school when they were choosing the angels for the school. Anyway, don't go there. Then at the age of seven, my father had the opportunity to sell this very, very old mansion we had that was falling down and needed lots of repair. It was a very poor area of Blenheim, actually, an industrial area. And he took the opportunity to buy a newer house, 60-year-old villa. It was a newer house for us. And we moved to Redwood Town in Blenheim. And so that was 10 days before my 8th birthday, and we moved there. And so I went to a different school, and I grew up. I was apparently, my friend Philippa tells me now, she remembers me, and I remember this too. I would have been 8, and I didn't have any friends at this point, hadn't anyone, and I was out on the lawn dancing to myself. And she reminded me about that. She said, I saw you across the road, you were dancing by yourself. I was so embarrassed. I thought, oh my God, the whole world could see me. But Philippa came from a Sally Army family, and I used to jump in their little Fiat on Sundays, and off we'd go to Sunday school, and then I spent a good, right up until 20, I was in the Salvation Army and went through all this amazing youth group stuff, which was really my family. Like, it was really, I got to go to snow for the first time, and but I was also an outsider too, because I wasn't an inside Salvation Army family, I was outside. But the I love the stories. I always loved the metaphor of the Christian story. It's always been part of my upbringing, and I completely rejected it through my 20s once I left the Salvation Army. But I've redefined that metaphorically, what that is, and it fits really well with my social justice, non-violent responses to the world. And we talk about the non-violent Jesus and progressive Christianity. So that's how I got to go to Sally. And you know, 2 years ago, I found out Philippa and I shared great-great-grandparents. We were fourth cousins. So when I did all the history of the area, I'm like, oh my goodness, that she was family, but we didn't know that. She was family and blood. So since then, you know, a lot of us left the army for various reasons. I left, of course, in 1985 because of homosexual law reform. You know, there I was, 15 when we did, I would have been 14 when the abortion debate started in the late 70s through the United Nations conversations and protests. And I remember as a third former picking up pamphlets at church that were slamming these women activists who supported abortion and starting to think. And then at 15, I was 15 in 1981 when the Springbok tour, yeah? And we had a lot of rugby players and in our church. Instead of being with them on Friday night, the church playing in the brass band, I went on the protest march against the tour. So this gradual political awakening that kept separating me from this particular core, as we call them, this particular branch of the Salvation Army, was I was just forming this politics, and I didn't fit. Like, I never fitted. That was that same thing about needing to leave Blenheim, needing to leave my family, and needing to leave the constraints of conservative Christianity, feeling like I was bigger than that, but not feeling like I was good enough. So at the end of my seventh form year, I was too scared to wear mufti in my seventh form year. You see a lovely butch picture of me in my seventh form year. I'm wearing my school uniform. Soft butch there, I think. But certainly that's where I'm starting to identify as lesbian. And not knowing that word. Just not knowing that word. And there's a whole pile of us. There's five of us and who came out. The other four are guys. And there was me in that youth group at that time. So we beat the 1 in 10 rule. We did the 1 in 6. I was engaged briefly to one of them. A lovely, lovely man who's one of my best friends. He lives in Melbourne now. We just love each other to bits, really. I contacted him when I was sick, and he came down from Auckland. I hadn't talked to him for about 9 years, and when I was sick, I was putting fears in order, and so I rang exes that I wanted to talk to. There was some I didn't want to talk to, and they came.
Why did you want to be involved in the Butch on Butch photo exhibition?
Well, I tossed and turned on that one. I tossed and turned on that one because Butch was a term I used in a relationship previous to my relationship now. And we did classify ourselves on those roles, butch femme, and that helped define our roles in terms of who did what duties. But we also, you know, we had those conferences going on through the early 90s. There were lesbian conferences. And so those issues were to the fore. And we had people coming and visiting about their books, you know, lesbian silence and all those kind of things, and lesbian, I can't remember them all, but so there were topics we were debating. And I remember thinking, yeah, if I'm going to put myself on that continuum, I would be butch. So when the opportunity came up, I started thinking of all the times in my life that I didn't fit. And I certainly wasn't feminine growing up, even though I had curly hair and, you know, I wasn't allowed to cut my hair. The day I turned up with cut hair after my grandmother died, my mother went silent on me. And she looked at me as I came in and I'd had my hair cut off. I'd drawn my own money out of my bank account. And she went, "Your grandmother wouldn't like that." I was like, "Yeah, no, she wouldn't." But I never fitted the feminine image. So I was always a tomboy. I got into lots of trouble through the conservative Christian, evangelical movement. I was a musician, so I would turn up in men's attire. I remember one Youth for Christ rally, I was wearing a tie. And I was having a good time. I'm a cornet, as you do. And remember, being a cornet player in a Salvation Army band, you're in a male domain as well. So I was quite comfortable in that. But this woman, young woman, came up to me at the end of this Youth of Christ rally and said, "Jesus is asking me to talk to you that you have not accepted your femininity." And, I mean, I laugh now. I was devastated because I didn't know I was wrong, because I was just doing what I do. And I loved it. I loved it at school because we had school ties. I loved wearing the school tie, this bloody gold and blue thing. Oh, God. And so I was devastated, and I think it was probably the first time it was brought to my mind that I really wasn't female. But it's only been in the last maybe 5 or 6 years that we've started talking about gender fluidity and breaking down the dichotomies and all those things. And it was a really liberating, in the end, liberating to me, because I was starting to come out. And I then, tell a long story short, the first lesbians I met, the church really cornered me. You know, like, stop hanging around with the refuge because they're full of dykes and, you know, and people who have been abused often fall into, you know, girls who have been abused often fall into feeling like they should be in a lesbian relationship because it's nicer than, you know, and they do, that you become a lesbian because you've been abused line, which is what I got quite a lot. And I fell in love with one of those refuge dykes. So at 19, I moved in with her.
The Butch on Butch piece. Do you want to read that to us? This is the narrative that you had with your photo.
Well, I worked really hard at this because the last bit that connects this is that I'm an abuse survivor in my family, and I have a clear memory of locking myself in the bathroom at the age of 8, washing my hands, trying to get clean, and saying to myself, when I grow up, I'm going to be a man and rule the world, and no one will hurt children. And that stayed with me, and that created a split in me, and I had a whole male character for me to survive the next few years. So this is how it relates to some of this. Butch is the rejection of gender and sex binaries and the acceptance of me expressed in my look, choices, clothing style, attitude, and mannerisms. It is also the creation of my identity as strong in the face of violence while growing up. Some would call the splitting off into compartmentalised identities as mental illness. I have come to embrace it as strength, wise and intelligent, and have ultimately become the I who was all of those things in spite of what happened. Butch is therefore a part of how I see myself, rather than a separate part of the how we used to see me as ourselves. It's also a part of how others may or may not see me, connected, enhancing, challenging, creating, informing, identifying, entertaining, loving. Being 48, now 49 and nearly 50, and being able to say this as who I am is the most liberating feeling I have ever had. I think that one of the integral things we do as we grow older, as we find better and new ways to connect, and that part of that is telling our stories and telling them freely. So thank you for the opportunity.